From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The oil business is used to booms and busts, but what's happening now from the wellhead to Wall Street is different. An estimated 3.6 billion people worldwide are under lockdown. Cars are parked, factories are shut, planes are grounded, businesses closed. And earlier this month, for the first time in history, the price of a barrel of oil went negative, meaning oil producers had to pay somebody, anybody, to take their oil.
Oil prices have turned negative. The most extraordinary development that took place today when the U.S. main blend, West Texas Intermediate, fell more than 306%. It is negative $37.63 a barrel. That means producers are paying to get rid of the oil.
If you're going to be breathless on TV, how about a historic point to do that? That was from CNN Business a little earlier this month. But the big question now is, are we witnessing a turning point in the fossil fuel industry, an acceleration in the transition to new forms of energy? So this hour on Point, the COVID pandemic and the oil business. Well, we will start today in Houston, Texas. Well, Mitchell Furman joins us from there. He's economy and energy reporter for the Texas Tribune. Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, that negative price per barrel from earlier this month, how much of a shock was it?
Yeah, it was definitely a devastating shock in a month of many days of devastating shocks. It was, you know, small oil producers in Texas have already been feeling it for weeks. You know, the effects of the coronavirus on the oil industry and from Houston to West Texas, really across the state.
Mm. And just to be sure that we all collectively understand how that happened, is it because the demand for oil has dropped so much that the producers can't stop pumping it out of the ground and they didn't have any place to store it? What drove that negative price per barrel?
Right, yeah. The people staying home around the world has driven that demand to a kind of devastating place for oil producers. And it, you know, that's most of it. And then it's also that Saudi Arabia and Russia got into an oil price war in early March, and which resulted in Saudi Arabia ramping up production at a moment when the world didn't need more oil.
So what impact, we'll come back to sort of the big geopolitical questions here, but Mitchell, what impact is this oil shock having? I mean, on Texas, for example, you're right there in Houston. We were told on the show a couple of weeks ago that Harris County, a third of the revenues for Harris County relies on the oil industry, at least a third.
Yeah, in Houston, local budgets and the state budget are going to be greatly impacted. The state budget receives billions of dollars from oil taxes and royalties, as do plenty of local budgets around the state, including here in Houston, like you said. And so that's going to impact services for people, you know, daily services, because budgets are going to the state comptroller in Texas, Glenn Hager. He said earlier this month that, you know, there's going to be a, you know, agencies are likely going to have to make cuts. State agencies.
Mm. Are they concerned that this may be the harbinger of a longer term shift in the demand for oil?
It's tough to say just yet. You know, there are oil producers are hurting and they don't exactly know when the tide will shift. You know, we're seeing some states reopen, but, you know, it's kind of too early to tell what that means for demand in the short term and long term.
Okay. So to go back for a moment, Mitchell, to what you were talking about, what was happening between Saudi Arabia and Russia, the president did indeed tweet that he managed to strike a deal between the two. Has that deal helped Texas oil producers?
Demand is in such a devastating place that it's tough to see how that deal is really helping at this point. It could in the long term, and it's, you know, the story changes daily and several times a day, so it's just tough to see how anything can really outflank the brutal demand drop.
Mm. Well, and you know, we talked about the revenue drop that's coming along with it for Texas and Texans. I'm also seeing in your reporting here, Mitchell, that it's also having a really big impact on jobs in oil country, right? Like you reported that Houston-based Schlumberger, the world's largest oil field services, how much of a loss has it suffered? How many people are losing their jobs because of this?
I mean, it's thousands. They're just one in a number of oil companies who are having to lay people off. It's from big oil companies that are based in Houston and have operations in West Texas and across the state. Like you mentioned, are laying off hundreds and sometimes even more. And then there are small oil producers across the state who, you know, might employ 10 people. And they're having to furlough or lay people off. And it's, you know, who knows when it's going to end.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk to one of those smaller producers right now. So Mitchell Furman, economy and energy reporter for the Texas Tribune. We've got links to Mitchell's reporting at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Mitchell.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, let's go now to Perryton, Texas. And John Bozeman joins us. He's co-owner of Bracken Operating, LLC, a company that buys oil and gas wells from drillers. He has managed to keep himself and his partner and his 8 employees in business for now. John Bozeman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about your business, how many people you employed, what you did before the shock of this pandemic set in?
We're what the larger companies would refer to as a mom-and-pop organization. We have family members that work together. We've got approximately 10 employees, 10 households that either take all or most of their income from our company as employees. We do occasionally drill wells, but typically we buy wells from larger producers, and after the well doesn't produce as much, and try to improve production and be more efficient and lower overhead.
Got it. Well, you just heard Mitchell Furman say that a lot of the smaller producers, maybe you included, Mr. Bozeman, are worried about going out of business. Is that a concern for you right now?
It's beyond the worry standpoint, where it's a fact that we're on life support. I will give some credit where credit is due. We took advantage of the, I believe it's called the PPP, mm-hmm. the Payment Protection Program that the federal government did, and we took advantage of that. And, of course, we're putting 100% of the money we received towards our employees. And because of that, we have not had to lay anyone off. I'll point out, I even actually added an employee. Mm-hmm. He's not a beneficiary of that program. I'm paying him out of my back pocket. He did excellent part-time work for us and lost his job. And I said, what's the least you can take to keep a job around here, because your talents are so valuable to us? And so he gave me a price, and we're trying to keep him. He's a single father, and we're trying to keep him employed as long as we can with him. But we took advantage of the PPP. When that runs out, we cannot make payroll.
Wow. And so it's like you said, you're on life support right now.
That's correct.
Do you worry that even after the country gets through this pandemic and the economy starts picking up again, that there might be some longer-term changes in the price of oil? A lot of analysts are wondering if demand will ever bounce back to where it was just a year ago, which was at all-time highs.
If I might, I probably differ from some. Like any small businessman, you just have to be an optimist to be self-employed. You have to be an optimist to go out and risk your time and your efforts and your money in the hope of a return. And so I am an optimist. I don't necessarily require a tremendous price for the products. I just need I like to say that like the wheat farmers that I grew up with as a child, we eat low prices for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And we can deal with low prices. We can't deal with the zero prices and zero place to put our product.
I'm not sure. I can't imagine a single person or business that could deal with the zero price or even the negative.
Yeah, we do things. It's our business to reduce costs and be more efficient and work hard. And we have a lot of confidence that we can survive at some level. In my opinion, there's two things going on here. The large one is the COVID crisis. The demand is that's a new factor in crisis. The other factor is an oil price war. And what that really has to do with, in my opinion, has more to do with the fact that the United States took about 20% of the world export market away from the Saudis and the Russians, and they want a piece of that back, and they're going to get a piece of that back.
Well, you know what? That's exactly what we're going to talk about when we come back from a quick break. We'll take a look at that big oil price war and global demand as well. So John Bozeman, co-owner of Bracken Operating LLC, joining us from Perryton, Texas. Thank you so much, Mr. Bozeman.
Thank you.
Well, we are talking about the future of oil and whether this demand side shock that we're seeing right now because of the COVID pandemic could signal an acceleration in an energy transformation around the world. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about how the pandemic may be changing the future of oil around the world. And joining me now is Megan O'Sullivan. She's director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She's also a professor of the practice of international affairs there. And she published a recent opinion piece in Bloomberg News just yesterday, in fact, headlined "Oil's Collapse is a Geopolitical Reset in Disguise." And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Megan O'Sullivan, welcome to the program.
Hello, Meghna. Great to be with you.
It is great to have you. And also joining us is Philip Verleger. He's owner and president of PK Verleger LLC, an energy and economic consulting firm whose clients include firms, governments, and individuals. He was formerly on the Council of Economic Advisors in the Ford administration as well. Phil Verleger, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you, Meghna.
It's great to have both of you. So I actually want to step way back just a couple of months. It seems like way back, to be perfectly honest. But Megan, I'll start with you. Give us your sense about the price war that did emerge earlier this year and how much of a preamble that was to the massive changes we're seeing in the oil markets now.
Great. I'm glad we're starting here because as we heard from our first two interviewees, this price war is looming large in people's minds as being responsible for, at least partially responsible for, this big oil collapse that we've seen. And it's true that the world has experienced, almost in an unprecedented way, a supply shock, extra supply, and a demand shock, a massive drop in demand. But I would like to just point out that the demand shock vastly out strips the supply shock. And let me just give a couple of numbers. I don't want to flood your listeners with numbers, but I think they can put it in context. So in mid-March, when this price war began, Saudi Arabia started producing 2.5 million more barrels of oil than it had been at the beginning of March. But this is in the context of a drop in global demand of 30 million barrels for April out of a global market of 100 million. So, you know, it is significant, the increase in production, but it was really dwarfed by the decline in demand. Even if the Saudis had not done this, and the Russians actually, I would say, were the real instigators of this, even if those two countries have not engaged in a price war, we would have a very dramatic oil collapse nonetheless. Now the Saudis and the Russians have agreed to pare back their production beginning tomorrow to 8.5 million barrels a day, which is important to put in the context, again, of this drop in demand of 30 million. So no one was under the impression that, you know, this deal was going to solve the problem. And keep in mind that they're now going to be producing significantly less than the United States is producing. The U.S. continues to be the largest producer of oil in the world by far.
So we'll get to the more specifics of the deal in a moment. But Phil, you heard John Bozeman, our small producer, in the previous segment say that, you know, he believes that the price war from March was a direct result of the U.S. taking a large chunk of the global oil market. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely correct. I heard that, and he's singing from my playbook. And I've taught economics at Yale and other places. And what everybody who follows the international side misses is that the Saudis and the Russians are foreclosing the market on the U.S. The U.S. is going to not be the largest oil producer in the world. We saw a situation where the administration has talked about U.S. energy dominance, and they've denied our dominance. We have been shown to be a paper tiger as far as the oil business goes. Our producers are high-cost producers. And what the oil-exporting countries have done in foreclosing it is denied our producers access to storage in Asia. They have filled ships. And so yesterday, when EIA said we were exporting 3 million barrels a day still, Platts then came in and said almost all of that oil is going to storage in the Caribbean or as far away as South Africa. And essentially, U.S. producers are going to be forced to shut down. Our production could fall by as much as a third, and fairly quickly.
Well, but hearing Megan's point earlier about the demand shock far exceeding the supply shock, would the U.S. oil industry be shown as a paper tiger, in your words, if we hadn't had this, like, historically precipitous drop in demand?
Well, perhaps not. The Saudis in early March, March 4th or 5th, tried to talk the Russians into cutting production and getting everybody else to cut production, noting that the virus was depressing demand, and depressing demand by numbers that they came up with. I mean, if you early in February, I'd written a paper that said that if you look back at the 1918 virus, what you'd expect to see is something like 7 to 8 million barrel a day drop in U.S. worldwide consumption for the year, which is our numbers that other people are talking about now. But the fact of the matter is the Russians didn't go along, and the Russians, in fact, decided that they wanted to start this battle to foreclose the market to the U.S. And foreclosure is an antitrust concept again, and they are just, you know, it's economic warfare, but they have the low cost production and they are able to squeeze.
Yeah. Well, Megan, go ahead and respond.
Sure. You know, I have a different perspective. I completely agree with Phil that this is hurting the U.S. industry. I think the idea that our production will go down by a third is, of course, nobody knows. The numbers right now suggest a significant decrease in production, but not things quite on that scale. But I think, you know, looking at the motivations of the Russians and the Saudis as distinct from, you know, what their, you know, what has actually affected the U.S. is important. So the Saudis learned a really tough lesson in the 1980s when prices were really low. They were the only country in the world that was continuously cutting their production to try to prop up a price. And everyone else who was a producer was benefiting from their efforts, but they kept losing and losing market. And they vowed at that time that they would never be in that position again, where they were the only country in the world cutting production to boost the price for everyone else. And that's what the Saudis were trying to avoid in March. They actually came to the market, as Phil pointed out, and said, let's do a further cut to keep the price up. And actually, in March, they asked for a cut of 1.5 million barrels. So it gives you an indication of how little people knew about the scope of what would become a 30 million barrel of day drop. So they asked for 1.5 and the Russians rejected that. And the Saudis simply did not want to be in that situation where they were the only ones cutting production to the benefit of the Russians and the Americans and others. And so that's why this war started, because they wanted to try to get the Russians back to the table, get them to agree to a production cut as quickly as possible. Of course, it spiraled out of control because it was in the context of this demand drop that people just didn't anticipate. Nobody imagined in the early March, March 7th, that the world would be immobilized, the global economy, that a third or half of it would be virtually immobilized, and what that would do to oil demand. So again, I think it's true it's hurting American producers, no question about that. But I don't think that that was the first driver of the Saudi action.
Phil, what do you think about that?
It's, we won't know for some time. They took some steps that, they agreed to cut production when President Trump intervened, and that meets with what all the people who followed the global oil market for years have followed. What one didn't notice, but if you looked around and started watching, was they were chartering ships and in excess of what they needed. They had quietly gone out and lined up a lot of storage capacity in Asia, and after the event and everything, Occidental had its employees write their politicians to complain that they were being denied access to storage. So now this is kind of, if you think about economic game theory and war, and it's really that's inside baseball stuff, but this is how you maintain your market. And what they did with their pricing just recently, after the agreement with Trump and everything, for access to Asia, was they cut their prices again to make sure that they kept the Asian market, they pushed the Russians out, and they pushed the U.S. out. So they are playing a very sophisticated economic game, and nobody's paying attention.
So there are a couple of big questions here that I want to get to in a minute. And one is like the immediate future of the oil industry, both in the United States and globally. And this question of an energy transformation. But before we do that, though, Megan, I am curious. You heard Phil a couple of minutes ago say that there could the Saudis and perhaps the Russians' efforts were to foreclose on the U.S. market. We have the sort of the double punch now of that price war and the pandemic, as you have pointed out. So whether by design or by luck, will the Saudis achieve their goal?
Right. And again, I'm arguing that that is not their first goal. I think certainly there's no question about it that the energy phenomenon in the United States and the increase in shale oil production has really changed the realities for the worse for the Saudis and the Russians and other producers. It's that the whole energy global landscape has changed. And I remembered I was on your show a couple of years ago. I had a book out about this called Windfall, about how this boom in American production has changed global politics. And a lot of those things remain true today. Now, the issue is that, of course, the market dynamics are different, and that is because shale is present. And so Saudi Arabia and Russia and others have to compete for a smaller market. And that's just a reality. So they would like that to be different. But given the resilience of American production over the last, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, I don't think they used to, but I don't think they any longer imagine that they're going to be able to snuff out the American industry. And I think that's something that many of your listeners may get be under the impression of from hearing, you know, a reading a variety of things that the American oil industry as is at risk of disappearing. I think that is certainly not the case, and it would be misleading for people to suggest that. It's going to change dramatically, and for some small producers like John Bozeman, who we just heard from, and others, this is an existential threat. But to the oil industry as a whole, my sense is that our industry is certainly going to survive. It probably will come out of this crisis more efficient, but it will look very different. There'll be a lot of consolidation, a lot of bankruptcies, as I think Mitchell, who you spoke to first mentioned, a lot of bankruptcies. So there'll be a different producer profile, and will probably grow more slowly. But I don't doubt that the United States is going to continue to be the largest or one of the largest producers of oil in the world.
Interesting. Well, also the world that this oil industry will emerge back into will be different as well. But
yes.
Megan and Phil, hang on here for just a second, because On Point producer Dori Scheimer has slipped into the studio. She's got a roundup of some questions that are popping up on social media about this topic. So, Dori, what are people saying?
Yeah, it's interesting based on what Megan just said, because a lot of our listeners are not seeming to be very sympathetic of the oil companies in the U.S. or even more so globally. So here's some of the questions we got from Erin on Twitter. She asked why we're not taking this unprecedented moment in history to invest in green and renewable infrastructure and are instead using government bailouts to help the fossil fuel companies.
Okay, so Phil, do you want to answer that? Because that is one of the big questions here. There's been a lot of writing in the past couple of weeks about whether this the demand shock is going to open the door to an accelerated energy transition. What do you think?
I totally agree with Erin. Having been in the administration when we decontrolled oil and followed oil consumption for a long time and energy consumption. We are moving away from fossil fuels. We're moving away very rapidly. One of the reasons the U.S. industry may not come back very quickly is because, the majors will come back, but most of these independent companies can't get capital anymore, and they have been positive cash flow only once or twice in the last 10 years. So I don't know why we're bailing them out. Three, 4 months ago, we were talking, even in February, we were talking about how investors were shunning the oil industry and moving towards green energy. And if you look at the trends, green energy is going further ahead. Meantime, Wall Street has turned its back long before the coronavirus hit, and it was essentially saying, no, we're not going to lend you any more money, produce cash, and at these prices, these firms just can't get cash. And the one other thing I'll add to the comments, since I've been dealing with the Saudi economics people for years, including the minister, Sheikh Yamani years ago said the Stone Age didn't end for a lack of stone. And what the oil producers have come to realize is that the oil industry, global oil, demand is not going to end because we ran out of oil. A lot of oil will be left in the ground, and they want to make sure it's U.S. oil that gets left in the ground and produce as much of theirs as possible. So, I mean, Erin is exactly on point. We need to move faster away from it, and this is an industry that Schumpeter would say should be allowed to just wither.
Wow. Dori, do we have another comment?
Yeah, one question from Bram on Twitter. He wants to know why he should care as an individual about the price of oil, of a barrel of oil, going into the negative.
Megan, do you have a response for that?
Sure. And if I might respond to Erin as well.
Sure.
I think that looking at the price of oil, we always look at it from the sense of a consumer and then the sense of the industry or the overall economy as a whole. And for the longest time, Americans, and President Trump included, were really focused on the lower the price of oil, the better for the consumer, better it is for the driver, for heating your home, whatever you might use oil for. And it's really, this is the first crisis in which I think it's become apparent that America's oil industry is so significant to our economy that it actually is a major knock on our economy. So while it might not affect Bram personally in the same way, it does affect the national economy, and particularly depending on what state he lives in, it could affect the state economy. And that is manifest in ways that Mitchell talked about, you know, unemployment, but also tax revenues. A lot of states get a huge amount of tax revenues from the oil industry, and the federal government does as well. So we're now at a point, I think, in our national development where the oil industry is so significant in terms of employing people directly and employing people indirectly, that a low oil price can be more detrimental than it is helpful to consumers, especially at a time when no one's able to drive.
Well, Megan O'Sullivan and Phil Verleger, hang on here for just a second. Dori Scheimer, thank you for bringing in those comments from On Point listeners. We are talking about the future of oil and how the COVID-19 pandemic may be changing that future. There's a lot more to discuss. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the future of oil and how the global COVID-19 pandemic may be changing that future. And I'm joined today from Denver, Colorado, by Phil Verleger. He's owner and president of PK Verleger LLC, an energy and economic consulting firm. He was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Ford administration and a special advisor to the Treasury Secretary in the Carter administration. And also with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Megan O'Sullivan. She's director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and she recently published a piece in Bloomberg News titled "Oil's Collapse is a Geopolitical Reset in Disguise." And I, one of the questions I have for both of you is, we are in this demand shock, this bottoming out of demand for oil. It will creep back up for sure, but will it ever again reach the heights that it was in the past couple of years? And I'm not I actually think that it might, Megan. I'm looking at the EIA, is the U.S. Energy, the EIA's latest outlook for consumption, and they say it's claiming that the total world consumption by 2021 will be at 101 million barrels a day, which is more than it was in 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, this is one of the really big debates out there, Meghna, is not just will demand get back to its, let's say, December 2019 levels. And I think many, or I would even say most, I certainly associate myself with this view, people think that it will, but really a question of when will it get back to those levels? And I think there's some strong arguments to make that even when the global economy kind of normalizes a bit, some of the last things to come back are going to be oil-intensive activities like flying. That's a huge part of global energy consumption. So there is this question about will demand come back fully, and what time frame? And this gets back to the question that your previous caller asked about, which was this taking advantage of this moment to advance the energy transition to a more sustainable global energy mix. And I think, you know, if in fact it takes some time, maybe 2 years, for demand to come back to December 2019 levels, then, you know, there's an opportunity there for renewable, more sustainable alternative energies to come in and substitute for some of that demand. So there's a concept called peak oil demand, and that's something people had been thinking about for a long time before this crisis. People's views on when the world would, you know, reach its maximum oil demand varied pretty widely. But most people, even people who were thinking very ambitiously, thought it was well beyond 2025, maybe in the 2030s. Some people even thought it was in the 2040s. I think now we can be confident it's earlier. It's earlier than it was before because we have this gap. And a lot has to do with what governments do with these huge stimulus packages we know are going to be needed.
Yeah. Phil, go ahead.
I think that oil demand peaked last year. And I've been barrel counting and forecasting since 1971. Several reasons. One, globalization is ending. It's going way back. Out of 100 million barrels a day we consume, 8 million barrels a day is used by the maritime industry. That's going to go down. Second, it's going to be years before people will get back on planes the way they were before. So we take it out there. Third, the economy, growth of the economy is going to be much slower because of all the debt that people haven't paid, the rent strikes and so on. So we're not going to come out of this quickly. And meantime, in Europe and in Asia, people are moving ahead. Volkswagen just restarted its plant manufacturing. What are they manufacturing? Electric cars. So what the virus is doing and the economic slowdown, which is going to take 3 years or 4 years to recover from, is giving the electric vehicles a huge push in Europe and so on. And in the United States, nobody's going to be buying autos for quite a while. So, you know, Ford and GM probably will have to go back into bankruptcy and receive a federal bailout again. By the time we come out of this, demand will be down sufficiently that it's just never going to get back to 100 million barrels a day where it was.
Okay.
We've peaked.
Okay, so let's presume for a moment that that's true. And in fact, an area of overlap between the two of you is neither of you are saying that we're going to have to wait till 2040 anymore for that peak demand. Okay, so we have an accelerated time frame here, whether it's now or the next 5 years. But the thing about oil, the thing about energy, right, is how energy moves around this world is fundamental to how civilizations move, how our societies are operating. It is the table at which geopolitics is set. So if we have this accelerated timeline of an energy transition, Megan, this is what you've written about. Are we also looking at a concentrated period of destabilization for a lot of these oil-dependent economies? And what does that mean geopolitically?
Sure. I think it's certainly possible. I would say if we're looking for more certainty, we can say we actually are going to see destabilization of oil economies in the immediate term. And we'll see some more in the short and medium term. But right now, just because of this demand drop and this price collapse, there are a lot of countries, and they're not just in the Middle East, that are very, very dependent on oil revenues to pay maybe 90% of their government expenditures. So Iraq falls into that category. You have countries like Ecuador and Venezuela, Algeria, I mean, countries all around the world, Nigeria in a very difficult position. So in the very short term, you have countries that are not able to meet their budgetary requirements by a long shot. Many of them can't even meet their government payrolls right now. And so they can't fund their health budgets or their security budgets. So the risk of failed states, I think, has gone up dramatically in just the last 2 months because of this oil price collapse. Now, you mentioned the energy transition, and of course, this is a longer term threat to some of these countries. But of course, there is more time for these countries to prepare. And so we've seen countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, others that have, you know, a stronger government structure and a deeper economic base, acknowledge that they're going to have to diversify their economies dramatically if they're not going to have a major crisis in their economies a little further down the road when the world does move away from oil. Because Saudi Arabia and many of these countries in the Gulf are the lowest producers of oil in the world, they will likely be the last people producing oil. You know, the world is going to keep consuming some amount of oil, and it is likely going to come from the lowest cost producers in the Gulf. But they know that they're on an unsustainable economic model. So they have to use this time, you know, if it's 2030, if it's 2035, or if it's 2025, you know, their timeline for diversifying their economies has shrunk. And they're aware of this, even if they haven't been able to take adequate steps yet.
So, Phil, do you think that Washington is thinking about what the next 5 years may hold in terms of what it would need to do regarding foreign policy and the possibility of failed states, as Megan is talking about? And secondly, there seems to be an opportunity here. I mean, you mentioned Germany and electric cars. Why not take advantage of that same opportunity of the energy transition here in the United States?
Well, the answer to the second question is we should. This administration won't. I have no fear. I defer to Mr. Sullivan on most of the global policy issues, political issues. My focus is economics mostly. Mm-hmm. But I would just simply say, if you want to get a view of the future, look across the Caribbean at Venezuela. Venezuela is a failed petrostate. You just look at all the pictures that have come out, the horrors of the hunger and no pharmaceuticals. And this is what is coming for Nigeria. This is what's coming for Ecuador. It's coming for other states. Mexico has been prudent since Pedro Asprey was the Minister of Finance, who started hedging their oil in 1991. Mexico next year, if this continues, is going to face similar problems. And it is, and even Canada is going to have to redo its budgets. This is the new normal. And so your question is exactly right. There's going to be a lot of instability. I think this is why Saudi Arabia wants to push hard to increase the volume of oil it sells, recognizing it's not going to get the same as higher price. So, the Middle Eastern countries will persevere and survive because they have the low-cost reserves. A lot of other countries are going to fail.
Yeah. Well, Megan, we have about a minute left to go. It does sound as if this is a profound historic inflection point that may change the trajectory of how the world consumes energy. And it's a trajectory we had been on for a century.
I agree. And I would say that despite the risks that we've talked about, there is a real opportunity here. We know the importance of an energy transition, and we know how destabilizing it can be. And we've had this moment for all the difficulty associated with it. It is a chance to push ahead the energy transition in a more systematic and strategic way. A lot of it has to do with how our infrastructure is going to be built. And we're going to be considering big bills that won't just be the Trump administration, but also Congress. So I think there's a huge opportunity here. And I fervently hope our country will take advantage of it and help other countries around the world do the same.
Well, Megan O'Sullivan is director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She recently published an opinion piece in Bloomberg titled, "Oil's Collapse is a Geopolitical Reset in Disguise," and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Megan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Megna.
And Phil Verleger, owner and president of PK Verleger LLC, an energy and economic consulting firm, former member of the Council of Economic Advisors. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating conversation about oil on the show today. Tomorrow, we will be doing our week in review, and we want to hear from you about how you experienced this week. Is your state moving towards reopening for business, and has that changed your behavior? Leave us a voicemail. Call us at 617-353-0683 with your questions or observations about this week. Again, 617-353-0683. Well, radio is a strangely powerful medium. We never see each other, or almost never, and yet we here in the studio feel incredibly and deeply connected to you out there on the other end. We're an invisible but tightly bound community. And earlier this month, WDET in Detroit lost an important member of their community. Lost that member to COVID-19. He was Tom Wilson, known on the airwaves as Tom from Northwest Detroit. Tom was a regular caller to Detroit Today. He was a teacher and community activist who shared his insight and curiosity about the world and his hometown with other public radio listeners. And Stephen Henderson, host of Detroit Today, joins us to talk about Tom's legacy. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Magda.
So tell us about Tom. When did you find out that he had passed away?
I actually didn't find out until it actually happened, which was the day before we did our tribute to him on the air. I literally was just going through social media and saw lots of people who knew Tom talking about the fact that he had died. I didn't even know, for instance, that he had been sick with COVID-19. I didn't know that that he was in really bad shape or anything. But all of a sudden, it was as if he had just been snatched away from us in an instant.
Well, he had just called in. I mean, not all that long ago. He called into your show last month. We have a moment here where he called you and shared advice on how he was managing with Michigan's stay-at-home order.
You know, I make it a point. You know, I'm not out long, but I make it a point to get out every day. You know, I do like a little bit of yard work and what have you. And I mean, just, you know, go out on your front porch or your back deck or whatever. Just stand there, get some fresh air and some sunshine. It, you know, it makes the day better.
Hmm. Can you tell me more, Stephen, about why Tom was such an important and beloved part of the Detroit Today community?
Well, I mean, when I come in here and get ready to do the show each day, you know, Tom often was on the line to talk about whatever we were talking about before the show would even start. He would hear the billboard, the opening promotion about the show and call in. I mean, he was the most constant presence on the show other than me. And that was true even before I was here. The previous hosts of the show could talk about the way in which Tom was just part of the infrastructure here at Detroit Today. And so that's one of the reasons I think that it's gotten the reaction that it has to his death, is that there isn't anyone who listened to this show who didn't know Tom. There's no one who read letters to the editor in our newspapers here in Detroit who didn't know Tom. He was a prolific letter writer. There's nobody who was involved in community activism here in Detroit who didn't know Tom. I mean, he really was a pillar of this community in so many different ways. And so the idea that he is just suddenly gone and that we will never hear that cheerful voice or disposition again is really jarring.
Right. And the void, the immediate void that's left by just not being able to hear his voice every day. I mean, how has that hit you?
It's been hard. I mean, each day when I come in now and I look at the phones, that number is not there. I know Tom's phone number. And so even before the producers would answer the phone and type his name and I knew who it was, it's been really different to come in and know that not only is that number not on the line, but it won't be. And it's really hard, for instance, to listen to that last phone call that we had with Tom, where he was being Tom, right? Talking about how difficult things were, but that he was finding a way to find joy right now, which was every bit of who he was and the value I think he added to the discussions here each day.
Yeah. And that joy being especially needed now as Detroit is being hit so hard by COVID-19, right?
Yes. I mean, the sad truth is that my going through social media and discovering that somebody is dead is not limited to Tom. That's the way I've learned about several deaths during this. And we expect that will continue. I mean, each day I wake up and wonder who will be sick and who will be gone. And that's very different and difficult for us here.
Well, Stephen, we are so sorry about Tom Wilson's death. And thank you, though, for joining us today to help us at On Point remember him. Thanks, Stephen.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for taking the time.
Stephen Henderson is host of Detroit Today on WDET. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.